John 9. Remember, that from John 7 through John 10 is what Jesus said in and on the Feast of Tabernacles. And what we studied Tuesday night, starting in verse in John 8:20, this is what he said in the evening of the eighth day. You remember, to Jews, the day starts at night. So from 8:20 until 8:59, that's what he said on the evening, or the beginning of the eighth day, which is at night. I mean, that always gets confusing. Then, on beginning in chapter 9 and 10 is what he said on the morning of the eighth day, beginning in the morning. Now, in this case, that was a Sabbath day, as we'll see from verse 14. And so, you won't understand a lot of this that happens unless you understand that it was a Sabbath. Now, you have to keep in mind that he had talked about the night before, the lights going throughout Jerusalem, and he proclaimed then for the first time that he was the light of the world. And so now in chapter 9 we find what that means, how that's manifested openly. Okay, is everybody's head here?
Oh, I never saw that connection before.
What?
Well, the writer talks about that.
The blind man. What really stands out, it's like a whole scenario of superlatives. You know, you've got these huge torches, this huge temple. You know, all these, you got the biggest and the best and all this, and he says, I'm this. I'm the light of the world. And you've got these torches that'll fill every corner of Jerusalem.
Amen. Almost like a lighthouse, the way where they're built. It was that magnification. Remember, it was optical quality limestone. And you remember when we studied the pyramid, it was the same thing. The pyramid could be seen from Jerusalem at certain angles of the sun, and it looked like a shining, Josephus says it looked like a shining diamond in the southwest. Well, the temple was made of the same kind of optical quality limestone, highly polished, so you couldn't see the seams between the stones of the temple. But it was made in such a way that it was wavy, so that its surface was that kind of a wavy motion, and it did extremely weird things to light, because there was gold all over it, white limestone, highly polished. I mean, there's nothing that we have that can. It was five stories high. I mean, there's nothing we can have that can compare with it. Okay, everybody here? And as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Now, again, when Christ was in Jerusalem for the feasts, all evidence indicates that he stayed at, remember, well, some of you don't know this. Jerusalem was a city that was built only for feasts. All of the houses in and around Jerusalem, including all of the suburbs of Jerusalem, Bethany and Magdala and Emmaus, etc., all of them, the houses had to be two stories. And the upper story of the house was always for the pilgrims that came into Jerusalem. And there was different economic classes around the city. Magdala was, as you know, was the red light district. That's where the prostitutes were. That's why Mary Magdala wasn't her last name, or Magdalene. It was Mary of Magdala. And the only way that would be ever been her name is that she was a prostitute. But she was the first one that saw him. The wealth lived in Bethany, and that's where Lazarus, who was extremely prominent, probably was the rich young ruler that refused Christ. That was the Highland Park of Jerusalem. But in every case, the houses had two stories, and the upper story was always left vacant during the normal course of the year, and it was used exclusively then for the pilgrims that came in. Now, Christ stayed always at Mark's house. Mark was a 9-year-old boy, the one that says the Gospel of Mark here. Mark was a 9-year-old boy at the death of Christ. And his parents were very wealthy. And they had not just a house, but they had a compound with a walled compound. And it was a great honor for them, for their belief system, to have Christ stay upstairs. And so, well, it was big enough to hold all of the disciples. Well, actually, it was big enough to hold 120 people.
Because he was, when you fill this in for me, it was because he was like a rabbi, he was considered...
He was a rabbi of renown. There's no way now we worship, essentially, we give importance to idiots like rock stars or musicians or movie actors or sports. But in that society, the highest thing that you could be and the one that received by far the greatest honor was a rabbi. And a rabbi had to prove himself. He couldn't be a rabbi by qualification. He couldn't just have, you know, gone to the right school or something. He had to prove himself over a long period of time. So it was an honor. I mean, even now Christ, there's a price on his head. 6 months earlier, he healed a man on the Sabbath. That's illegal. It's considered it's a thing that's punishable by stoning because you worked on the Sabbath day. And so now Mark's parents are probably getting a little nervous about having this rabbi be their guest. But still, that's where he and his disciples are. And it wasn't that far from the temple. So now the things that we studied on Tuesday happened. Christ and the disciples went to Mark's place, spent the night. And now they got up again because there's certain ceremonies that took place on the eighth day, and they probably were there for the morning sacrifices, the Musaf. But I don't want to get into that. So anyway, the beggars sat on the temple, Well, first of all, the idea of being a beggar wasn't a very good idea in ancient Israel. It had to be extraordinary circumstances, and the reason is because they had the Dallas Project done right in ancient Israel.
You had no excuse to be a beggar.
Right, there was no excuse.
So you'd have to be somebody who was really disgusting.
Well, you'd have to be somebody, the only exception to that was blind. And so the blind were considered, it was not that bad. I mean, it was that they were beggars. But anyway, they sat on the Temple Mount, and it was a place in which they sat not inside the temple itself, but in the place where they entered into the temple to go into the court of women. You got that in your mind? And so they were passing by this to get into the temple, and the beggars didn't go into the temple. But it's a Sabbath day, and so the beggars can't beg on the Sabbath because that's considered their work, and it's illegal for them to work.
It's tough to be a beggar. You can't even work. You can't even beg anymore.
But anyway, there were more than likely. On weekdays, the beggars sat in front of this temple, and they said things like, "Gain merit by me."
Wow.
Or,
like,
"O tender-hearted, by me gain merit to thine own benefit."
Win coins with God. Give me
Jekyll. Seed faith.
But on the Sabbath day, they couldn't say that, because the saying of it was an illegal act, because for them that was the work. So they just had to sit there and smile a lot. And they tried to keep their places. In other words, there was not that many beggars, but they had territorial rights. I mean, it was like
a May and all these blind men scrambling around.
Well, it wasn't that many. I mean, we're not talking big numbers. But anyway, they had a place. And this guy had a place by the Temple Mount that was his. And it didn't matter whether it's a Sabbath or not. He would be there because it would remind people when they saw him when it wasn't a Sabbath. You got the picture?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we could talk about all those intricacies for the next 3 years, but that wouldn't get us into the scriptures. Now, you got to see, I mean, the disciples are just sort of hanging out with Jesus. They're walking and they're talking. And they look at this guy and they say, "Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Now, that's a typically Jewish question. Huh?
What?
It's Barbara's fault.
Barbara said that.
Well, Harry's not here.
Barbara's in. I'm sick. So
the Jews had a belief system at that time that there were certain sins that the mother did, or the father, that would cause the child to be born blind. And there were, I think, there were 24 different, I mean, this is all like it's precise. They believed until the child was 13 that whatever was wrong with the child was the fault of the parent's sin. You got that picture? And so this is a typically kind of a Jewish question. But it's a question of cause, and Christ is going to wipe out. It's a question of cause and effect. Who sinned, this man or his parents, that this guy has been born blind? Now, to have him to say that he was born blind meant they had to know a little about him. They knew, you know, it's like, sort of like the guy that lives across the street, you know, a little bit about him. And so they want to know cause and effect. You understand that?
Mm-hmm.
They got these, they're really sincere. Sincere Jewish questions. And Jesus wipes them out. He said, "Neither hath this man sinned nor his parents." I didn't mean that they were sinless, but it meant that it had nothing to do with this. "But that the works of God should be made manifest in him." Now, there isn't a question you can answer or ask that isn't and shouldn't be answered by that statement. It takes the mind away from causation and into mystery and purpose. You see what I'm saying? There is no cause for whatever situation that you're in save God himself. There's no, I mean, you spent a lifetime asking yourself this kind of a question about yourself, mostly.
Yeah.
Nothing is wrong. It happens so that God's work may be revealed. Can you hear that echoing through eternity to every conceivable situation in your life and in the universe? We're not interested in cause and effect. All right. Now he says, "I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work." Now, on the Park City's Baptist Church,
I was thinking that.
Yeah.
I can't believe you said that.
There is a huge clock on one of the little steeple things, and it says on the clock, "The night cometh when no man can work." What they don't understand is that the night came on the day of the crucifixion. No man can work since then. And that's why Christ said to the disciples and to the questioners, what can we do to do the works of God? The answer is only and ever and always, believe on him who he has sent. You understand? The idea is never, what shall this man do? Okay. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. I talked about that, but let's look at it another way now. Let's go to Matthew 5. We're going to come back here in a minute.
You know, I work this geophysicist convention, and one of my bosses was talking about how he was working in one of the meeting rooms, and this archaeologist type guy was talking about how they had unearthed more of the temple artifacts, and that they had a heifer, and they were so close to getting their shit together, working on the temple and all this, and I just couldn't believe he said that, and I said, God will never allow it to happen.
Yeah. They don't have the ashes of the red heifer.
Well, right? They don't. It's like, we found a heifer we can burn, you know. He's just talking about all this stuff, and I was like...
Well, next time you get in that discussion, if he's around, the heifer can't be burned because there's no container for it. The container for the heifer, anybody can burn a heifer.
Come on over here, Bobby.
But the container for the heifer has to, by law, be the same container that held the last heifer that was burned.
So there you go. I mean,
no, it's like
Ember burning's kind of been
out for
a while.
The red heifer, for those of you who don't know about it, the ashes of the red heifer are a mystical purification phenomenon. The temple is meaningless unless the artifacts of the temple are purified by the sprinkling with mixing in the living water with the ashes of the red heifer. But I mean, that's typical, yeah.
But the temple's been destroyed, it's not to be rebuilt.
Right.
He's just got an entire or something to run around.
Oh, yeah. Well, Vendel Jones.
Vendel.
He's made a fortune and a life looking for the temple. I mean,
there's commerce in anything. Anyway.
Okay, Matthew 5, verse 14. This is the Beatitudes. This is the... You are the light of the world. What the hell did he just say? He just went over here and says, I am the light of the world. Now he says, you are the light of the world. And that's pretty mysterious. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Now, he says here, I am the light of the world. Now in Matthew, he says, you are the light. Now, you have to finally come to this conclusion. You have to finally face this singular issue that the slow dawning awareness of who Christ was happened in him exactly the same way as it's happening in you. If Christ in his earlier years, if some rabbi would have told him, you are the light of the world, his response would have been exactly the same as yours was tonight. But as the slow dawning awareness continued, as he saw the scriptures unfold, as he saw the feasts, he began to know with a certainty who he was. That is exactly the same process that is taking place in you. You are in exactly the same place that Christ was in his teenage years, right now.
How old was he? Like 17?
When?
When he first knew.
No, he didn't know for sure until he was 30. He knew,
but
a hint. Yeah, he had a hint of it in the temple when he was 13. Do you understand that? It's important. Otherwise, this will just be another religion to you. That's all that's going on in your life. Nothing else has any merit or any importance. But this slow, sure, dawning awareness of who you are. You are the light of the world, and it will come into your mind just as it did in Paul. Paul, after his conversion experience, he was alone for 3 years in the desert. Then he was silent for 14 years.
After?
After.
Can you move that closer?
He didn't write his first letter to a church for 21 years.
After Christ?
After he was converted.
After the experience that blinded him?
The Damascus Road experience. He immediately went to Arabia for 3 years. And then for 14 years, he was just a member of this group up in Antioch. A slow, sure, dawning awareness of who you are. That's the only thing that's happening in your life, period. Everything else is going to fall away. You are a co-heir with Christ of everything. All right, verse 6. When he had thus spoken, he spat on the ground. Now, throughout the Talmud, there's a story after story and great arguments. The fact that for almost all eye disease, the Jews used their own spittle to cure the disease, including everything from glaucoma to eye infections, and they believed in that it was... And so, on the Sabbath, it was legal for them to put spittle on the outside of their eye, but it was illegal for it to go on the inside. I mean, because one was considered work and the other was just considered a response or a reflex action. All right. But now he did this thing. He spit on the ground and made clay of the spittle, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with clay. He spread the clay on the eye itself, not on the outside of the eyelid, on the eye. Wow. Yeah.
On the eyeball?
On the eyeball. Okay?
What? My eyes water, just hearing
it. But hear that. That meant that the act of that... Well, first of all, he made clay. That's illegal under the law of the Sabbath. Then he put the concoction on the eyeball inside the eye. That's illegal. So it's two illegal acts already on the Sabbath. He anointed the eyes of the blind man with clay, and then he said unto him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is by interpretation sent. And he went his way therefore and washed and came seeing. Now what happened is, he didn't know what the hell was going on. This blind guy from birth, didn't know what anything looked like. He's sitting there in front of the temple because somebody brought him there and sat him down. This guy comes along and spits in the ground in front of him, mixes it with something, some dust, puts it on the eye. He's still blind. He still hasn't seen what's happening. And then he goes to a place which is where just the night before, the day before, the priests had gone to gain the water from the king's pool or the virgin's pool that was poured into the altar, and the out of my belly shall flow rivers of living water. Okay, you got that?
Yeah.
All of a sudden he goes to the pool and he takes this water and he looks and he can see for the first time in his life. He has no idea who the guy was. All right? But his sight was restored. The first act on the day was the sight was restored. But it was restored by clay made out of the ground with the spittle of him whose breath had first breathed life into that clay. And this was then washed away in the pool of Siloam, from whose waters had been drawn the Feast of Tabernacles, rivers of living water, the new life by the Spirit. Now, that act, his act on this day, was real, and that someone benefited from it, namely this blind guy. This blind guy had no faith. He's just sitting around. He's just hanging around. Some joker comes up and spits in the ground, mixes a little thing in his finger, puts it in his eye, says, okay, now go wash your eyes. The guy would do anything. I mean, now I can see. But it happened for your benefit, that you might see for the first time on the eighth day of the feast. You got it? In the spirit, you have been blind. You've been looking at things all your life. You look at, you look at, you look at. That's so old. Now, you look through. Now, wherever you look through it. You no longer see yourself as looking in the mirror. You don't ever think of yourself in terms of, you know, do you understand that your whole life has been spent looking in a mirror? Because everything you look at is, how does this affect me? Now, the only time you didn't do that was when you were that little kid before, and you just looked at everything with a sense of wonderment.
Speaking of that, last night, I don't care about just with her or anything, but they had her in the Capitol.
Oh, I saw that.
And she goes, Bush comes up and says to her, you don't remember me, but I know who you are. And like, you pat her on the head, something, and he walks down to the next dignitary to shake their hand. And then you hear Jessica go, Mama, who is that?
And then he went back to her. He went back to her, and she took his glasses off and put them on. And pulled his handkerchief out and put it on her head.
Yeah, it was like, Mama, who is that?
That little West Texas
accent
of her.
Amazing what you can get away with. But it was like,
you know, she had no...
Yeah.
She didn't give a shit.
She just wanted to know who it was.
Well, what I want to see is that you now can have the same empowerment to see through. You don't, you got to have suspected that to look at people, to look at things, to look at situations, and look at them and see yourself has not gotten you anything but misery. Now the mystery is completed. Now you're empowered by the eighth day, by the resurrection, to look through and see Christ in everything. And as you see him, you shall be like him, for you shall see him as he is. And then you too shall know that you are the light of the world, and you're the only reason the world exists. Now that's the reality of this gospel. That's the reality of the full counsel of God into which we've been delivered. It's the reality of all the cliches you've known all your life. Now they have to be realized. Everything exists for your purpose. You can never again be in need. You can never again be a victim. If everything exists for your purpose, then how can you be a victim? No response of another person can ever affect you negatively again. It can only be that which you see through to see his mystery. All right. He went his way, therefore, and washed and came seeing. He came back to where he started. Now, there's all kinds of people around here. They've known this guy that he's blind from birth. The neighbors, therefore, and they which before had seen him, that he was blind, said, is not this he that sat and begged? Some said, yeah, this is he. Others said, he looks like him. But then he said, I am he. Now, I mean, this is a big deal. Therefore said they unto him, how were thine eyes opened? He answered and said, a man that is called Jesus made clay and anointed mine eyes and said unto me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. Wash. And I went and washed. I can't say that word. And I received sight. Then said they unto him, where is he? He said, I don't know. He still hadn't seen him.
Didn't see him leave.
He hadn't seen him. He only had been party to the effects of him.
I didn't notice that.
Now, they brought to the Pharisees him that aforetime was blind. Now, they brought him to the Pharisees because the Pharisees had been on the lookout this whole feast for something to hang Jesus by.
So there was probably a reward or something for these people to drag this poor slob over.
And it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. What?
That'd been saintly, the charitable.
Then, again, the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight. He said unto them, he put clay upon mine eyes, and I washed, and do see. Therefore, said some of the Pharisees, this man is not of God, because he keepeth not the Sabbath day. Others said, how can a man that is a sinner do such miracles? And there was a division among them. Now, the Jews had a unique belief system that said that miracles could only happen to him who was righteous, or by through the agency of him who was righteous. Sort of like modern-day evangelism. Now, Jesus just... They were caught between a rock and a hard place in an insoluble mental trick. On the one hand, he cured a man from birth, and on the other hand, he broke the Sabbath. How could this be? It was insoluble. They said unto the blind man again, what sayest thou of him that he hath opened thine eyes? He said, he is a prophet.
They go, who is you?
You gotta have this picture that's going on, that there was, for the last 6 months, he was the topic of conversation among the leadership in Jerusalem. He was like number one topic.
Didn't stuff like this happen a lot, where it was a dichotomy?
No.
Do something and it went against.
No, not like this. The Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight, until they called the parents of him that had received his sight. Okay, now they need some more witnesses. They're building a case.
Because he can't identify
it. Right. And they asked him, saying, is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then doth he now see? Now, his parents are now, they're kind of miserable. They're poor beyond poor, because there's no way even a reasonably well-off family would allow a son to beg. They had to be so poor that they were poor beyond poor. They had to be in a terrible position. And it says the Jews brought him, therefore it's the men of Judah, the leadership. You got the picture? His parents answered them and said, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind. Now, they have to be very, very careful, because the word had gone out that any man that was a disciple of Jesus of Nazareth, or Jesus of Nazareth himself, was to be cut off from the people. It had reached this point now, and this is now about, 6 months before the crucifixion. So the parents are walking real dangerous here. They're walking in fear, because they're speaking to those that have the power to exclude them from the synagogue. You remember there are three levels of excommunication. It's one for 7 days, one for 30 days, and one for forever. They're talking here about the one that was forever. When that one that was forever, that excommunication, there had to be an open ceremony in which the trumpet was blown as the man was led out of the gate. I told you before that when Christ was led out of the gate towards Golgotha, 400 trumpets blew.
Wow. I don't remember that.
Okay. So the point is, the parents are walking on eggshells here. His parents answered them and said, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but by what means he now seeth, we know not. Or who hath opened his eyes, we know not. He is of age, ask him. He shall speak for himself. The parents wanted to get the hell out of there. They wanted to give the minimum amount of stuff to get by. All right. These words spake his parents because they fear. Oh, it says that. I should have just read on a little bit. These words spake his parents because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if any man did confess that he was Christ, he should be put out of the synagogue. Put out, therefore, is that third degree of... Now, it doesn't say if any man confessed that he was Christ. It means confess that any man would confess that he, Jesus, was Christ. Yeah, you got it? All right. Therefore said his parents, he is of age, ask him. Then again they called the man that was blind and said unto him, give God the praise. That was like a liturgy thing to say, like... No, yeah. Yeah, it was just like a liturgy thing. In other words, say that God did it, but it had nothing to do with this man. We know that this man, Jesus, is a sinner. He answered and said, whether he be a sinner or no, I know not. One thing I know, that where I was blind, now I see. And that's the most heart-wrenching thing in the universe. I mean, that is the faith of the child. It's without judgment. Then said they to him again, what did he to thee? How opened he thine eyes? He answered them, I have told you already, and you did not hear. And now he's, well,
he's pretty plucky.
He's getting to be real plucky.
Yeah.
And he's plucky because the system that he'd lived under all those years had produced for him nothing but a basic, bare subsistence and a continued state of mental and spiritual blindness. And now he said, this is vanity. I don't give a shit. All I know is that I now see. I don't want anything to do with the system that I've left and come out of. Well, that's what you all have to say. I told you already, and you did not hear. Wherefore would you hear it again? Now he's gonna stick the knife in. Will you also be his disciples?
That seems to be like a bumper sticker of the day. You know, it's like, hey, you with this guy?
That got him. That got to him. It's like pulling the short hairs. Then they reviled him and said, thou art his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God spake unto Moses. As for this fellow, we know not from whence he is. The man answered and said unto them, why herein is a marvelous thing that you know not from whence he is, and yet he hath opened mine eyes. Cut him to the quick. Now we know that God heareth not sinners, but if any man be a worshipper of God and doeth his will, him he heareth. Since the world began, was it not heard that any man opened the eyes of one that was born blind? If this man were not of God, he could do nothing. Now they're really pissed.
He outrighteous them.
They answered and said unto him, thou wast altogether born in sins, and dost thou teach us? And they cast him out. They excommunicated him from being a Jew. A trumpet was blown, and he was led out of the city. He was no more, he was by their law and by their activity cast out of Judaism. And in spirit, he was cast out of the flesh. All right.
It's neat that they never really could come up with anything solid to dispute what he was saying.
Yeah.
He just said, who the hell are you?
Well, the solid, but I mean, you got to see that Jesus elevated the meaning of the Sabbath. I mean, we haven't gotten into this yet.
So in a sense, this might sound silly, but in a sense that was good that he was cast out, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was cast out of the old system. Totally. Okay, now.
Did they ever give him a name?
Yeah. And the other, another place is called Bartimaeus. Now, hear me. The next phrase is ever and always and eternally and cosmically true. Jesus heard that they cast him out. Now, no matter what environment you're in, no matter where you are, no matter what has taken place, the word cast out means it's a stronger meaning. It means forever divorced. Jesus heard that he was divorced and he sought him out. Ever and always, that's the case. But it cannot be the case until you are divorced from all of the old system. You can't be a disciple with one foot in the old and one foot in the new. Amen? Jesus heard that they had cast him out. And when he had found him, he said unto him, Dost thou believe on the Son of God? This guy's honest. He said, Who is he, Lord, that I might believe on him? And Jesus said unto him, Thou hast both seen him, and it is he that talketh with thee. And he said, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. Now, this is the first time that he saw Jesus. You got to see that. And Jesus said, For judgment I am come into this world, that they which see might not see. And they which see might be made blind. And some of the Pharisees which were with him heard these words and said unto him, Are we blind also? And Jesus said unto them, If ye were blind, you should have no sin. But now you say, We see, therefore your sin remaineth. Well, I wanted to do both 9 and 10 tonight, but... go to Psalm 96. I want to show you something. In other words, the other thing, the first act of seeing him was worship. And that's always the case.
It's like getting him, but him being to that place was by direct acts of Christ, even though, you know.
Christ was always in control. Yeah. God was always in control.
Even though he never was faced with, you know, oh, so this is who you are, until he was out.
Yeah. Until he was cast out.
Yeah.
Start in verse 8. Give unto the Lord the glory due unto his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. O worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Fear before him all the earth. Say among the heathen that the Lord reigneth. The world also shall be established that it shall not be moved. Now what that means is, it says in the Hebrew, it says the world is established that it shall not be moved. That means that all the things that are seen by the senses in the world, their system is established that it's vanity. There is nothing that can be done to overcome it. There is no act of God or no of God himself. There's no act of you. There's no mental gymnastics that you can make that this, the world is established and it shall not be moved. It's vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Anything that you can desire after the senses is vanity. And as the simplicity of it is to say, Father, I desire to be cast out of the world, that he may come, that he may see, that I may see him. It's like, don't you see? I mean, it's like, for us, it's too subtle. I mean, you know, in this case, to confess Jesus cost this guy his lifestyle, his life, his everything, his parents, I mean, his friends, everything. For us, it's just, we just hang around or not hang around. We try to live in two worlds, and therefore we wonder why there is no revelation. Cast out, see that it's divorced. And then he will search you out, and you will see him, and you will worship. And you shall know then that you too are the light of the world. Amen? Okay, that's the first thing. This little scenario we just read of John 9 was the first thing that he did on the morning of the day of the eighth day, or the octave of the Feast of Tabernacles. And it has to do with seeing and sight.